In episode 114, Stuart chats with John Robinson, a current board member of Golf Australia who has refereed at 25 Australian Opens. John chats about his late start to the game, what got him interested in the rules, and where that journey took him, including a TARS course at St Andrews. John provides his most important principles of being an effective referee and shares some stories of some difficult situations he has had with players over the years, including with Dame Laura Davies. John provides some tips for rules enthusiasts who want to start applying that knowledge as a referee at events, shares which rule still confuses him, what rule he would like to introduce or change, and finally the rules that still frustrate him.
But just before we get into that episode, I want to encourage you that if you like these podcasts, please share it with a friend or two. Send them a link and get them listening. As well as the podcast, Stuart and Blakey also produce The Drop Zone, which is a weekly rules newsletter. It gives you some helpful hints, a few rules questions, and there is usually a funny video to keep you entertained and educated. So send us your email address if you have yet to sign up, and when you receive the newsletter, make sure to forward that on to your captain or manager at your club. They are free to distribute it to all of their club members. We also have merchandise that you can purchase so that you are representing the best golf rules podcast in the world. Grab a t-shirt, a hat, or even a hoodie featuring the Rules Roo or the Wombat Caddy. And now, whether you're in your car or going for a walk or just taking a break after mowing your lawn, enjoy this episode of the Golf Rules Questions podcast.
Oh, you see referee David Blake there. He's obviously talking to one of the rules officials up by the green.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 114 of the Golf Rules Questions podcast. My name is Stuart McPhee, and it's my pleasure to be here with you. No Blakey again today. He is on tournament duty. We never seem to be able to catch each other at the moment. Either he's on tournament or I'm on holiday or both. Currently he's on tournament. I won't be on my own all of today. I do have a very special guest whom I'll introduce shortly. However, before I do that, I need to get through the golf rules question of the week from episode 113, which Blakey read out at the end of last episode. If you didn't quite hear that, here is the question. In a stroke play competition, Stuart hits his tee shot into a heavily wooded area. He properly plays a provisional ball under rule 18.3b, and it comes to rest in the fairway. He searches for the original ball for 1 minute and declares it lost. Stuart walks over to his provisional ball and accidentally kicks it. He does replace it, but before he plays it, and within 3 minutes of starting to search, a spectator finds the original ball. Stuart lifts the provisional ball and plays the original ball to the green. He takes two putts and tees off on the next hole. What is the score for the hole? Well, this question ends up being quite straightforward because it didn't matter what happened to the provisional ball because it never became the ball in play. So the fact that it was moved and replaced, and normally that would incur one penalty stroke added to the whole score. It never became the ball in play because the original ball was found within 3 minutes of that search time. There is nothing Stuart can say which can make that ball lost, so him declaring it lost has no effect whatsoever. You would think he would know better than to come up with that sort of tomfoolery, but he tried. It was a loss. Provisional ball never became the ball in play. The original ball was always a ball in play. And the score for that hole is simply a 4. There is a clarification under rule 6.3. 6.3 relates to the ball used in play of a hole. And it certainly does talk about wrong ball in that particular section, but that's not what we're talking about here. There's a clarification under 6.3, which is titled Meaning of Penalty Strokes Solely from Playing That Ball. And it talks about that there are examples of penalties that are disregarded because they could not also apply to the ball in play. And there's some examples mentioned, like if you're in the in a bunker with your provisional ball and you touch the sand in your backswing, that would normally incur the general penalty. But if that provisional ball never becomes a ball in play, that penalty disappears. It doesn't happen. Deliberately touching or causing your ball to move is another example. Again, if that provisional ball never becomes a ball in play, that penalty goes away. If it does become the ball in play, then that penalty is certainly applied. And there are some examples in there also. Making a practice stroke during a hole, it doesn't matter which ball that's going to apply, even if you were doing it sort of about to play a provisional ball. Obviously, if you're asking or giving advice, doesn't matter the status of any ball that you currently have on that hole, you're going to cop that penalty. And that's found under 6.3C. So that's the answer to the golf rules question of the week for episode 113. And I hope most of you got that right. It was actually a pretty straightforward situation in the end. Well, today it's my pleasure to have a special guest on the podcast, Mr. John Robinson. Welcome to the Golf Rules Questions podcast. It is great to have you.
Stuart, how are you today?
Yes, I'm very well, thank you. And thank you for sharing with us some of your time. I know you have extensive experience in the game and certainly within the rules, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you just about your involvement in the game. Now, a lot of people who are listening in, and we have a lot of listeners all around the world to this, fellow rules enthusiasts and in fact, tour referees as well, which is very humbling for us. For those who don't know about you, would you mind just sharing with us a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. Just a little bit of background before and how I sort of got into golf. I actually came into golf quite late in the game, pardon the pun. I had very heavy business commitments with my own business and children's sport every Saturday, and it sort of precluded getting engaged in the game. But so I was sort of a driving range wizard at that point in time, wildly keen about sort of every aspect of the game. And this eventually led me through a rather circuitous route to being elected to the board of Golf New South Wales. And for 6 years, I was there, which culminated in me assuming the chairman's role. And when I concluded the 6 year, which is the constitutional limit, I then moved and was elected to the board of Golf Australia, where I am currently a director. I've been there for 5 years, and I'm in my sixth year at this point in time, and that will be my final year on the board of Golf Australia. So my background behind all of this, which has some bearing on my golf journey, is one in IT, which allows me to engage in a lot of the expanded digital offerings that are coming down the pipe from Golf Australia. And I was very active in the development of the Golf Australia handicap app, which we're pleased to say now has got over 320,000 users.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's been quite something. So that's sort of the background to how I got into the game. That's probably enough for people to want to know.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, so clearly that gives people an insight into your experience at the executive level, like at the highest levels of the game in our country, both with Golf New South Wales, but also your current role with Golf Australia and the amount of, you know, the scope you would have, you know, the overseeing everything about the game in this country. It's interesting your story would be so similar to many others, and that is life gets in the way. And it's the children, and it's the children's sport, and it's work and business and establishing a career and getting into the game late. Like, I guess a lot of men, and certainly women, do as well. But what we haven't touched upon, and we certainly want to talk about in this chat, is where did the interest come from the rules? Because I know your experience in the rules, you know, where did that spark come from?
I was introduced by golf to golf by a very close friend of mine who sadly is no longer with us. And we used to play golf three times a week late in the afternoon. And we played for a virtual trophy called the Cesar Romero Trophy. And there was only one rule. You couldn't lay up. You had to go for everything. And we played off the tips. And it soon became apparent that if I was ever going to progress my game, that a knowledge of the rules was sort of paramount if you want to improve your golf. Most other sports, whether it's tennis or football or whatever, you've got someone else managing the game and telling you what's going on. But golf is a self-regulated game, and you really have got, if you're going to be fair with yourself and fair with the people that you're playing, you've got to understand the rules. So I had a look at the training material that was available, and it was scant at the very, very best. What was available was lacking and was definitely not easy to learn from. And so I decided, well, I can learn more about this. And I went and bought myself a decisions book. And I have it here.
Oh,
and,
wow.
and that's back in 1996. I don't know if you can see that
clearly. I can see it. And for those listening in, yeah, a red covered book with 1996 on it.
And I can tell you that it's probably a collector's item now. So, but that didn't help. It really didn't. If anything, it confused the whole situation because I didn't understand the structure of the rules and what they were trying to get at. And so I thought, well, I come from an IT background. I'm used to doing a lot of training. So I started developing my own material. And I used animated slides in PowerPoint. And that material took on a life of its own. And eventually it evolved to the point where there are over 300 animated slides covering every aspect of the game. Wow. Stroke play, match play, all sorts of incidents. And they were all photos that had been shot on course in real situations. And this evolved to such a degree that I was asked to present it to several of the major clubs in Sydney, where I'm based, and clubs like Eleonora, Concord, Royal Sydney, Longreef, and the Australian Golf Club, which has hosted the Australian Open on numerous occasions. And I found that when I presented to those clubs, the training material took on a much more meaningful profile if I were to go to the clubs beforehand, talk to someone at the courses and say, look, where are the tricky areas on the course? And I would go and photograph them and then build them into the presentation. And so the presentation grew and grew and grew. And it was very, very well received. And we made them sort of fun nights where I would ask questions of the audience and give out Pro V1s if people were successful in answering the question. And this really got this got back to Golf New South Wales, who heard about the presentations and asked me to come and present it to their rules committee. Now, the rules committee at that point in time was very, very active. And so I did. I went and presented it to it, and they really liked the material, and they decided to start adopting it and using some of that training material in conjunction with some of their own. Excuse me. And from that, they invited me to sit my club level accreditation, which I did. And the result I got in that exam led me to an invitation at state level. And so it went on from there. So it was sort of born from a sense that you really don't understand the game unless you understand the rules.
Hmm. So when you've started with your late friend and gone and playing with other people, what was your reaction when you found out how little most players knew about the rules? How did you feel about that?
I probably wasn't surprised initially because I had the same experience myself. I mean, personally, I didn't understand them, so why should I expect anybody else to? And what did amaze me, though, is that they were low markers, you know, 1 and 2 markers at the club where I was playing, and they had as little knowledge as a 30 marker or a 45 marker. And so I thought, well, gee, you know, this is crazy. They should know more. What can we do about addressing that? But, and I guess in a sense, and you realize this as well, that even when you do PGA events and elite amateur events, the same situation exists, perhaps not to the same degree, because there are monetary considerations that are going on and they're looking for rule verification and things like that. But I don't think I was surprised initially, but as it went on, I just thought, people aren't getting any better at this. There's got to be tools available to help them. So,
okay, now, so we've learned about, you know, doing the club level exam, and I know you had to get quite a high mark, you know, maybe something like 96, 95% or something to then go to that state level. But I know you've done more than that. So where has the rules journey for you gone beyond that? And we can include R&A and what's that look like for you?
So club accreditation led to state. And then my result there, and I got an invitation to do the state course, by the way, was a live-in course over 2 days. And I got invited to an advanced state accreditation course, and that was another live-in course. And that took me to a national level of accreditation and ultimately an invitation to the R&A in St Andrews to do my TARS 3, and which I did. And that was a great experience. The R&A did a great job. They took over the St Andrews Bay Hotel ballroom, and they built basically a live course in there with even revetted, real grass revetted bunkers, like, you know, 5 or 6 layers with sand in the bottom of them. not 30 or 40 layers of revetting, but enough to you for you to appreciate what was going on. And they had bridges going over painted water and, wow. and all of this. So they went to great lengths to make it a very affirmative experience. I've always been very appreciative of having the opportunity to do that. I think it rounded out my experience enormously and helped my confidence levels. So.
And that was over several days?
Yeah, it was. That was a week. It was basically a week. You know, I think it was 4 days. And you did an exam on the first morning. And that's now changed. They don't quite do it the same way now. So doing that there, and it was freezing in St. Andrews at that point in time. I mean, the course, the old course was open. There was no one on it. I walked around it. And there were a couple of people hitting the odd ball, and they were playing off little patches of artificial turf, you know, six inches by 6 inches. Right. But anyway, it was a great experience. One of the other things in my journey with the rules was I looked at the club level accreditation, and when I did it, it was paper exam. And you would go and do the training 1 week, and then you would sit the exam the following week. And it was 50 questions, might have been more, but I think it was 50 questions. And then that was marked manually. And I thought, there's got to be a better way to do this. I mean, people often can't get back. We should be allow them to do it from home. So I developed and wrote the software for the club level accreditation system to run completely online. And they would sit the exam online. I think there was a pool of something like 1,200 or 1,600 questions. And they were all pitched at that level, but they were the selection was randomized. And so you could request a profile of questions or sets of questions in a profile. And if someone happened to come across, if they did it multiple times, they came across the same question, the multiple choice would have been randomized as well. So if it was an answer C, the first time they did it, if they used C again, they weren't going to get it right because they had to know it. So there was a lot of stuff in that. And it also generated reports that went back to all of the states. This got adopted nationally in Australia, and the reporting went back to the states, so they knew who had passed their club level accreditation, and it generated the certificates that were sent back to the people that they could frame and recognizing their achievement. I also was involved in the delivery of state-level accreditation training, the online training, which includes a whole lot of on-course scenarios and where your people are put through, you know, tricky scenarios, and it's amped up a little bit to try and give it a little bit more venom, closer to the sort of the attitude you might incur or experience on course, you know, the sort of thing where you could rock up and they'll say, well, where the hell have you been? You know, that sort of thing, you know, what, thanks for coming along, you know, which you might be expected. And so, yeah, anyway. And then I started writing the Golf New South Wales rules quiz, which I did for a number of years. That was 10 questions every week. And I still write a quiz for a bunch of things. I think you might have been a victim of experiencing some of my questions.
Yeah, definitely.
So
not a small bunch either, this group at your club.
Yeah, they're not. There's about 150 players that are involved in it, and I still write it. I think the important thing to remember for anyone who's contemplating this is that, you know, your rules journey never ends. It's ongoing. You have to stay at the wheel. And not only are there changes that you've got to become familiar with, you know, the Joint Rules Committee, they're still pumping out stuff every 4 years, but you get stale. If you aren't doing things, you know, you forget, was that a definition or is that in a rule? What was that rule number? All of that sort of stuff. And it's not that you experience doubt, but you've really got to stay tuned. It's like any car that's been tuned up to do a perform a particular function. Unless you keep tuning it, it's going to drift. And that's why I think that this is just a never-ending journey in that regard.
Yeah, I just could not agree more. The term I use, whether I came up with it or not or adopted it, is it's a perishable skill. If you do know everything you just said, if you don't keep at the wheel, keep on top of it, you will lose it. I'm surprised at how many people think they've done a level two and they're good to go. Like, they're okay now. They don't need any more training or ongoing. And we have a little small, you know, chat group amongst a few of us, you know, Blakey, and we're constantly firing questions at each other. And some of them are very straightforward. Some of them are just sanity checks. You know, am I missing something here, and others are quite complicated. Blakey's one of the best at coming up with just stupidly ridiculous, complicated situations just to keep us on our toes. Now, you talked about venom and attitude, and this is something I really want to delve into from the, right. You know, what we can get from players. My experiences have been, you know, in the official guide, you know, over 500 pages, there is very little guide, very little guidance on being an effective referee. There are many who learn about the rules, do the state level accreditation, level two and the like, but then they want to take it the next step and start applying that to real situations, not just a club level, but beyond that to elite amateur and maybe professional as well. Well, there's not a lot in the guide about being an effective referee. What do you think are some of the, you know, the tips? What are some of the really important principles of being an effective referee?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There isn't anything in there of merit, and there's a huge difference between knowing your rules and being an effective referee and being able to handle the heat of the situation and being able to manage players, potentially players that are under stress, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, difficult caddies, when they're on the clock, or you know, there's time pressure and all of this sort of thing, and maybe you're running out of light for the day, and you know, you're slowing them up, getting their round completed, and they don't want to come back tomorrow morning, you know, that sort of thing. So I think the other thing to bear in mind is you mustn't lose sight that professional golfers are actually working. This is their livelihood, and they work in a tournament, and they play in a tournament trying to earn a living. And it's hard. It is really, really grueling. You know, you look at the TV and you see the elites and you see the John Rahms and, you know, the Scottie Schefflers and Nelly Corders and all of this that are, you know, they're right at the peak of their game and they're earning a good living. You know, they've got good sponsorship. They've got everything's going for them. You know, they get their parking spot at the tournament and they get their own car and all of that sort of thing. So you've got to keep that in mind. And so my view of the world is you've got to be there to help. You've got to get the job done. You're not there to give them a lesson in rules. You are there to correctly resolve an issue, and you are to get them on their way as quickly as possible and in a positive frame of mind, if you can help that as well. I believe in that. Because I've seen situations where referees can aggravate situations, and that you definitely don't want that. So your language and demeanour have a big bearing on the outcome, on how the player reacts. You've got to arrive at the scene. And remember, you may not be walking with the group. You may get radioed into a situation and you're driving in a car. And you've got to set their mind at rest. I mean, it may have taken you some time to get there, time that is precious from their perspective. And, I arrive there and I say, good morning, well, good afternoon. And if I know their Christian name, I'll say that, and I'll say, how can I help you? And so I'm trying to deliver a positive message that I am there to try and do something positive for them. You know, there's a saying, what do you call, what's the collective noun for a group of referees? And the term penalty has been mooted. And I think that the tour players sometimes think that that's the case, you're out to ping them. And I've had situations where, yes, you've had to do that, but other situations where you can certainly help them avoid that. And that's what I think that's your role as much as anything. I think the other thing to remember is don't overcomplicate the issue. You're not there to teach them the rules. They don't want rules numbers. Get the ruling done and get out of there. And you need to give them positive communication. How you communicate with them, the language that you use and your tone of voice will set the scene for how they'll react. And if they get aggressive, which it's never directed at you, it's always direct really at them, that they've got themselves into this predicament and you don't want to take it to heart and you just roll with it. And I'm going to talk a little bit later, if I get the opportunity, about a couple of scenarios where that sort of things happen. It's quite often that a player that's waiting on a ruling is getting out of position, and they are potentially already being timed or are likely to be timed. And one of the other things you can communicate to them is say, look, I'm realizing this ruling. I mean, a ruling might take 5 seconds. It might take 5 or 10 minutes, depending on how complicated it is and where things are going. You need to say to them, I realize this is going to affect your position on the field. Don't you worry about that. I'm going to radio and I'm going to communicate what the impact, time impact of this ruling has been on your group so that you just don't suffer the consequences of that. And I think that that helps put them, you know, you don't want to fix a ruling and all of a sudden they're worried about time and they start rushing. Yeah. And their game deteriorates as a result. And we've all seen situations where that happens with players. Like those ones that, well, sometimes when they're put on the clock, the game gets better. So I think the other thing to remember is while you can't tell a player what to do, you can ask them what their, would you like your their options explained to them? And most of the time they'll say yes. And in doing that, they often get insight into something you probably knew all along about what's the best way out of this predicament, but you can't say that to them. But you can, you know, they may see that. If you lay out all the options, they may twig to the fact that they can do more. So we've established that the goal is to get the best outcome for the player. If you're unsure of a ruling and you want to set the player's mind at rest, or even if you're sure of it and the player is uncomfortable with it, then use your radio. Jump on your radio and confirm that the ruling over the radio. And if warranted and there's still a problem, you can call for a rover to come and assist at the location where the ruling's taking place. And if a rover does attend, of course, they'll take over the ruling, but they will not normally converse with you beforehand just to understand what's been said and what the precursor to it is.
Yeah.
Another thing, it's very easy to forget, if you're giving a ruling anywhere on the course, but particularly around the putting green, you can easily forget that there are other players in that group. And you can be talking to the player, giving a ruling, and you can drop it here and you can do that all of a sudden. And then you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, there's these other players that are still trying to play. So you've got to be aware of that, got to watch them, and at the appropriate time, shut up. And just say to that you know, signal to the person you're giving the ruling to, just point to who we're waiting on, and just wait. And they understand that, they would expect the same courtesy. Mm. I think one of the things I've seen a bit of, to bear in mind, if you're a referee, you do get times when a spectator is hit by a ball, and when that happens, and I've seen it happen at a lot of tournaments, when they're particularly with tight galleries or galleries where there aren't ropes on the course. And the gallery squeeze right in. To me, the first priority is to the spectator. And, you know, the ball may have gone into a funny position and may require a ruling, but sort out if there's any harm being done to the spectator. Ask them if they need medical assistance. I always ask at least twice. Even though if they say no, I wait a few seconds and I say, you sure about that? You don't need medical assistance. And you just want to be sure that they're okay and then go on and deal with it. And you might touch base with them once that they're finished on the green or wherever it's happened to be. You might just walk past and say, you're still okay. And, you know, that I have had a situation where a player went down, happened at the Lakes, and we did have to get medical assistance in. And that person was taken off the course back to the medical centre. A couple more things on the list. Just remember that everybody makes mistakes. And you just learn from it. There's no good sweating on it. I mean, I'd have situations and you worry about it and like, what could I have done better or all that sort of situation. And if you have made a mistake and it's impacting the player immediately, you've got to let them know. And if it's had any bearing on the field, you've also got to let, you know, a rover know or the tournament director know. But if it's that you've got the right result, but you've got it for the wrong reason, for example, you know, I mean, certain situations like, you know, obstructions or GUR or whatever it happens to be, you can end up in the same place. And if you've ended up in a right spot, I would still talk to the player, but not while he's playing. I'd go to him after scoring and I would just say to him, look, you know, back on the 11th or whatever, you know, I said it was this. It actually wasn't. The result was correct. It doesn't affect your score. You haven't signed anything incorrectly. Just want you to know for future reference.
Yeah.
Another dynamic you have to take into account, if you're bringing one of the final groups in a tournament and it's being televised, there will be a set time for television close. And they want to run the television, or they want to run the tournament up as tight to the close as possible. And you will get radio chatter saying, John, can you slow that group down a little bit? We've got a bit of time, we've got to burn. Or hurry it up, will you, please? We've only got 10 minutes left and you've got a hole and a half to go, or whatever it happens to be. And so all of a sudden you're getting yet another complicating factor. And particularly, this always happens, by the way, when you're in the middle of a ruling. And I've got a scenario I'll tell you about there. One final thing you need to be aware of. You'll get times when the gallery's unruly. And I just don't mean noisy, because it's very easy to just say, quiet, please. And if you've got, you know, quiet sign carriers there, that's fine. You can signal to them to move over and shut them down. But I've had situations where galleries have been drinking a lot and in the final group, and they've been abusive to one of the players. Yeah. You know, oh, no one's interested in watching you play. Why don't you just walk off, you know, and let the person who's going to win it do this sort of thing? Mm. So I immediately do two things. I firstly radio and I say, we're likely to need security at this location on this hole. And then I'll go and talk to the gallery. And if they're really tanked up, you don't know quite how they're going to react. So it's best to have security on their way at that point in time. And they will deal them. And they'll take them off the course. I mean, we've had situations where they will do that. It's very rude and it's very offensive to the players, because all of the players are trying, and they're all trying to make a living. So, and finally, I think to remember that as a referee, you're just one cog in a very big wheel. One instrument in the orchestra pit that's trying to play in tune with everybody else. Yeah. And, you know, to deliver an Australian Open, it takes 800 to 1,000 volunteers, including referees and, you know, people delivering water, or marshals, or crosswalk managers, or rope managers, or whatever it happens to be. And the tournament's not about the referees. They might be important in getting it delivered in accordance with the rules, but they are they're just one of a whole lot of people that makes these tournaments happen. Just keep that in mind and stay humble about it. And don't keep throwing yourself in front of TV cameras if you can walk behind them.
I've been told that a few times.
Yeah, I know. So,
have I done makeup yet? All these sort of jokes that go over the radio.
Yes.
Get out of the camera. Anyway, yes. John, terrific. As we said right at the outset, there's very little guidance. And I think it's so important that we get, you know, ideas and principles, you know, tenets almost, from people like yourself who have had so much experience, and just pass that on. We need to be able to have this knowledge transfer. So thank you very much for sharing those. I just wanted to pick up on a few of them. We've known each other a few years now and you've been very helpful to me. And I think one of the first things you taught me in dealing with a player was, do not mention a rule number. If they ask, by all means, but don't quote them rule 9.4B, exception 2. They do not care. So I vividly remember you telling me that. Do not cite rule numbers to them. They could not care less. another one I think I may actually adopt now, just hearing you talk about it then, was if the ruling is taking a little bit longer than, you know, it's a car path, yeah, there's your nearest point, one club length, you're good to go, and it can be quite quick. If it's a bit more involved with that, just tell them, look, I'll radio through. Don't worry about the time. I'll let everybody know that this has taken a few minutes. And I think I've never even really thought about that previously. I may have said it, but not consciously thought about it. And I think that's a really good, if it's going to take a while, pass that on to the player. So they just, it's one small thing they're not worried about. Because, yes, you know, a lot of players do worry about that time, and they know who the slow players are. They get, you know, put him in a group with one, they're worried now because, oh, their group's going to be under the watch, you know, because they've got one guy in their group who's a bit slow or notoriously slow. I also like your comment about options. And when you say to the player, would you like all of your options? Yes, of course they're going to say yes, even though they probably know what they're going to do and you probably know what they're going to do. But I think it's important for them to go, oh, hang on, because every now and again they'll be, oh, I didn't realise I could do that. And all of a sudden, I can think of Gabby Ruffles at the Cathedral. Like, she went straight to a drop zone for a penalty area. And her ball, and she only called me over because her ball was full of mud, because she retrieved the ball from the penalty area. She said, can I clean it? And so that's why she called me over. And I said, yeah, you can clean it or change. I'm just going to use the drop zone. I said, well, you do have other options. And I said, because back on the line was a lot closer to the hole because it, you know, the drop zone was about 30 metres back. And so even just that options, even though she was definitely going to the drop zone. And I just said, oh, would you like your options? And she said yes, and she ended up going back on the line right next to where the ball went into the penalty area, even though she was, because the drop zone's so obvious. You know, it's right there. It's clearly for the penalty area. Well, that's terrific, John. Thank you very much for sharing some of those principles. Now, we did mention this, and you talked about the Australian Open and being a very small cog in a huge number of people who deliver that product. You've refereed a lot of Australian Opens, and I know the number is probably around 25, which is an extraordinary amount of experience. You've obviously come across some very big names in the game of golf who have come all the way and played in our National Open. You don't have to mention the names. You can if you want. Do you have any stories you're willing to share? Certainly any difficult situations you've come across with players and how you've resolved those?
Well, given you just raised the issue about options, maybe we'll start with one there that happened at Royal Melbourne with Lydia Ko, who it was Australian Open, and she's world number one at that point in time. And Lydia had pulled her on a par four, had pulled her tee shot left, and it had gone in under a tee tree, which was laid over at an angle. Actually, it was like that. Yeah. And the ball was up in the wedge part of where it was laid over. It was obviously completely unplayable. And I was nearby, and she called me over and she said, well, what can I do there? And, you know, we talked about, you know, you can go back and you can go back in line. Now, going back in line would have put her on on another fairway with high trees and a very complicated shot to get over. So I said, look, but there are some other things that you might be able to do here. And I said, you've obviously got lateral relief, two club links in either direction. And she said, well, that one's not going to get me anywhere because I'm getting deeper into the trees. And I said, no, but I said, let's have a look at the other one. And I said, don't lift your ball there, but let's measure it out and stick a tee in the ground and see where you would get to if we dropped within the two club links. And we did that, and she immediately twigged to what I was getting at, although I hadn't said it. That put her right behind a television tower, which is a TIO, with either side relief option. And she said, what happens with that television tower? And I explained, you've got either side of relief. And she said, well, where would I get to? And I said, well, obviously you're going to be interested in the fairway side of the thing. And she said, yes. So we went over and we took line of sight, and that was still off the edge of the TIO to the flag, and put a tee in the ground. And that was still partially behind a tree. But then we measured the gutter, the one club length gutter where you can't drop, and we were clear of the trees. And then she had another, the next club length in which to drop. For one shot, she went probably 15 metres from within a stand of trees to the edge of the fairway, put her next shot to about 4 feet, and sank the putt. And there you go. So she got a par. And that was a case in point where, I mean, I could see that immediately, but she wasn't able to, I couldn't tell her that. I said, you know, you've got to drop it here. But by walking through the process, she jumped on that straight away. And I thought that was a good outcome.
Yeah,
certainly
definitely.
From her perspective, it was. But it's not always straightforward. I had another situation at the Bonneville Ladies Classic, which is a co-sanctioned event with the Ladies European Tour. And on hole 12, which is a dogleg right, I got radioed in to give a ruling at someone at the drive. This was just said, ruling required at the drive, 12, and that was it. So I arrived there, and there's a ball in the middle of the trees, a dogleg right. The ball's overshot the fairway, and it's got into the middle of the trees. And the between the flag and the ball was a toilet block. And, of course, that was a part of the course. It was not a TIO, and so there was no free relief. Beyond that, there was a generator and a bit of a TV set up. And the player turned out to be Laura Davies, Dame Laura Davies. Now, if you don't know who Dame Laura Davies is, she is the best British female golfer of the modern era. She's had 87 wins. and on the LET and LPGA, including four majors, and is a member of the Golf World Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. So she's a highly accredited player. She is, off course, the nicest person you would ever run into, but on course, she is all business. And she knows her rules, and she will, like some of the players are apt to do, test you. So I arrived there, and her first comment to me was, I put four tees in the ground. I just want you to tell me which one is where I can drop. Now, the four tees basically were on either on the outskirts of the building, the toilet block, level with her ball, not near the flag. And then there were another one, several back, probably spread out over about 25 metres.
Hmm.
And I looked at her and I said, Laura, I'm sorry, but none of them are correct. And I said, you've got to play that ball as it lies. She said, no, this is a TIO. I said, no, it's not. She said, but there's a television thing on the other side. And I said, well, yeah, there is, but you can't advance your ball to that. You can't get it up there. So you do not qualify for TIO relief. And she said to me, No, that can't possibly be right. And I said, well, you know, and then her caddy came over, and her caddies can be fairly formidable as well. and she said, made some comments, and I said, well, thank you very much for your input. I said, I'm going to deal with Laura on this now. And I said to Laura, Laura, if you're not happy with that, I'll get you a second opinion. Tell me if you want it. To which she didn't respond. And I waited about 20 seconds, and I said, Laura, she said to me at that stage, well, what happened with my second opinion? And I said, well, you didn't tell me that you wanted it. So I then radioed, and I had an earpiece in. So it was a silent call. As far as she was concerned, she couldn't hear the conversation. And I radioed the TD, and I said to him, situation, he knew the area on the course. And I said, it's played as it lies. There's no physical interference, no ball interference, no swing path or anything like that. It's just line of sight. And I've denied relief. And she would like a second opinion. I said, I'm going to go open mic now. And with that, I removed the earpiece. And I said, Laura is the tournament director. He's aware of the situation. And I'm going to ask him to give a ruling on the situation. His response was polite but very firm, and said, the ball has to be played as it lies. Click. That was the end of it. I mean, he just ended the call. So gone. And I said, Laura, you've got to get on and play. And so she did. And regretfully, she tripled the hole, which was not a good situation. And it was sort of almost over, except for a couple of holes later, she called me over again. And she said to me, is with a smile on her face, she said, perhaps this time you can help me, which I thought was a good retort. So you never know what you're going to get. Do you want me to keep going?
Yes, please. No, please.
Okay. Another one that comes to mind happened at the Australian Open at the Lakes. The last hole, the 18th hole, which is a par three at the Lakes. And I had just finished my group and was just leaving the green when a ball went whistling over my head. It was blowing like crazy. And in fact, the television tower that was at the back of the green, they removed the television camera off it because I worried about the wind, and actually blew the television tower over. It had that black shade cloth on it. It blew it over and it collapsed. Fortunately, it didn't hit anybody. And so it was really howling, you know, it was squalling quite badly. So this ball lands near me, and because there's, you know, pedestrians and spectators.
Sorry, John, this ball has come from the 18th tee, from the group behind you.
Over my head, and I'm to the right of the green. The ball's hit the ground and scurried along the ground, and I sort of lost sight of it a bit because of the number of spectators were moving around. And I then saw it again, and I saw it roll up the other side. So it crossed the path, and then on either side of the path, there's like a downward slope to the path. So there's the bit of the rubber section of the path, a concrete curb, and then grass. The ball is rolling, and a St. John's ambulance paramedic picks up the ball and walks off with it. And I went after him. I said, stop. Please, it's not a problem. I just need to ask you a question. And with that, he just rubbed his forehead and he said, oh, my God, what have I done? And then threw the ball towards the putting green. And so we've now got this ball that's been intentionally interfered with. It's been thrown towards the putting green. And so I went, we got the ball and I went back to where the last point I'd seen it moving. And I said to the spectators in the area, because they were starting to cluster now, and I said, did anyone here see what happened? And they're all going, yeah, I don't know what happened, you know. And they're all, they're nine sheets to the wind, and they're volunteering probably less than accurate information, which was funny at the time, but it wasn't helping resolve the issue. And so I looked around, and there was a policeman there, and the policeman walked over to me, and he said, I saw exactly what happened. Okay. I said to him, I suspect you're a reliable witness. And from that, his feedback, we were able to determine that the ball was headed back across the path. It had gone across the path towards the clubhouse. It's away from the green. And it was rolling slowly towards the green on the path. And it would have gone across the concrete curb, a little bit up the grass, and then rolled back and come to rest on the concrete curb. And so we were able to reposition the ball. And then the player, who was James Nitties, arrived, and we had a discussion about relief options from the path and all that sort of thing. And the nearest point of relief no nearer would have been on the other side on a downslope. So he decided to play it as it lay, which was off the concrete curb. And with sparks flying, he gave it a good old crack, and he got it on the green, but he ended up bogeying the hole. So that was sort of one of the funnier ones.
Did that group with James have a walking referee as well?
They did, but he wasn't on site at that stage.
Much it was your situation because
we
got the ball back.
We got the ball in position, and then handed it off to the other referee and let him deal with it. He had at that stage he arrived. James actually got there before him, not by much. But in terms of determining it, it was better for somebody who was on the spot and who saw exactly, you know, what had happened and get the information together. Otherwise, the other referee, he wouldn't have known it. The ball could have been anywhere. I'm not even sure he saw that it had gone right of the green because of the nature.
You'd hate for a referee. I mean, it's a very small group of referees, but you'd hate for a referee to come along and go, no, this is my group. I've been waiting all year for this event. It's my group. I'm going to take over. No, hate for that to happen.
I gave it back to him. No problem. No problem with that. Okay. Another one happened with a player. I don't know whether to mention his name or not, but he's got a bit of reputation for being a bit toey. So we'll leave it at that. And we're playing at the Vintage in a New South Wales Open, and it's on the 10th hole, which is it got out of bounds down the right-hand side. And he plays his tee shot and carves it right. And he says to his caddy, give me another one. And he's leaning down and starting to tee it up. And I said to him, called him by his name, and I said, is this a provisional or are you playing three off the tee? And he looked at me with this spitting fire and venom and said, this is a ball, a provisional ball for a ball that is obviously out of bounds. And would the referee, please keep quiet while I'm playing. Okay. So, I took it on the chin. And anyway, he played that shot and he carved it right. And he said to his caddy, give me another one. Oh. And he looks at me again. And this time I haven't said anything at all. And he said to me, and this is another provisional ball for another ball that's obviously out of bounds. And plays this one down the middle of the fairway. Plays down the middle of the fairway. And then we walk down the fairway and almost immediately find the first ball inbound. So by asking him that simple question, I saved him four shots.
Yes, you have.
And he said to me at the end, he said a bit gingerly, he said, yeah, I would have burnt a few on the 10th, wouldn't I? And I said, well, yes, you would have. And he said, okay, well, thanks for that. You know, he was a bit contrite. But at the time, it was quite intimidating to have him sound out at me in front of the gallery as well. So you never know quite what you're going to get in these situations when these people start to, you know, when the players leak a bit of oil. It can be a bit uncomfortable. But anyway, that's part of the deal. I had a situation with in the Vic Open with Elvis Smiley, where he had cleats on the bag for him, and Mike Clayton, and it was the final hole, and if he eagled it, which he was more than capable of doing, he could force a playoff. And he, I was standing to the right of the tee, and there was a penalty area all down the left-hand side. And it was one of those snaking penalty areas. It wasn't a straight line. It went all over the show. And he carved it left, pulled it left into the, well, he's, I guess he pushed it left, he's left-hander. So he pushed it left into the, and it just flew in there, right? And he didn't play up, no point playing a provisional because we knew it was in the penalty area. He couldn't do that. And so we went down there, and there was a lot of gallery tromping around looking for the ball. And believe it or not, they found the ball, which was amazing. It was in grass, probably somewhere between half a meter and three quarters of a meter long. And so we're there talking about it, and he and Clates can't agree on what they should do, what the option. I said, well, let's run through your options. And again, of course, they're not interested in going back. And Clates said to me, well, we'll take an unplayable. And I said, well, unfortunately, you can't. You're in a penalty area. You can't have an unplayable ball. Your only relief is by going to, taking one of the options for where you've crossed the penalty line, or play it as it lies. Impossible to play it as it lay. And there were trees in the front of him. I mean, all sorts of rubbish. And so they then enter into a debate about where they could go. So we get walking back along the penalty line, and we went to where the two club links could be done, where it crossed originally. And Elvis Smiley was saying to me, he said, well, I think I'll drop here. And Clates is saying, no, there's got to be a better option. And meanwhile, I'm getting in the radio, they're saying, John, TV close is coming up. How fast can you get these people to the green?
What's happening? Yeah.
What's happening? And I'm saying, I'm getting it right, but it's taking time. They can't agree. And so we then we're walking back along this snaking red penalty line. They find a patch of grass. And he says, well, I can drop it here, can't I? Because that's back in line. Well, the tee, at that point in time, the flag was obstructed because it's a ropeless course, and the spectators have swarmed, with the group in front, have swarmed around the back of the 18th green. So yes. I can't spot the flag, and it's some distance away. And that has a huge bearing on where you're going to drop if you're going back along the line. So I radioed to the referee ahead, and I asked him if he could clear the gallery away from the frontage, that was frontage of the green, as you play it, and which he did. And I could spot the flag at that point in time. And the very spot that they picked was inside, just inside the penalty area that they were taking relief from. And so I had to again say, you can't drop it there. You can't drop it in the same penalty area. And so that option was out. So they went further back, and this time they got themselves outside, and they found a road on which he could drop. And it was a dirt road, and there were no loose impediments on it or anything like that. It was a thing. He said, well, can I drop here? And we worked out exactly where he could drop, and he did that, and away he went. Unfortunately, he ended up double bogeying the hole, and he didn't force a playoff. But it just, I guess I cite that as an example of how one question can cascade into a whole lot of other potential issues. And you've really got to be sort of thinking ahead, well, what can come next? You know, where can they end up? What are they going to be doing? And when you get a caddy and a player that don't agree, you're eventually going to reach a point to say, guys, we actually got to make a decision here and move on. Yes. Got to get going. Are we going okay?
You got another one for us? Yes.
I got another one for you. It was another Vic Open situation with Travis Smythe, who was in contention, and he's on the second. He's in the last group on Saturday, and we're playing the 11th hole, which is a par five, but reachable for guys with that sort of distance.
Yes.
And Travis does good drive, and then takes a crack at it, going for the green, which is pretty well protected by mounds and swales and bunkers and all this
waste
sort of
areas thing.
I mean, it's there's a whole lot of stuff going on. So anyway, his ball doesn't make it to the green, and it lands in just beyond a bunker in an area that is full of cast off sand blown out of the bunker. And it's amongst a whole lot of long grass. So grass that's probably, you know, 30 centimetres, even 40 centimetres long, and there's all this sand at the bottom of it. Mm. And his ball is embedded in that sand, right? And so he calls me over and he says, look, my ball's embedded in the ground, and can I, you know, I want relief. I just want to know what the procedure is. And I said to him, look, the ball's embedded in sand. It has to be in a closely mown area. You can see this is in long grass. And I said, there is no free relief from that. And he goes, oh, but the whole course is sand. You know, and he starts going off on this tangent about what happens on other tours and what's happening here. And there's a bit of confusion going on. And I can see his state of mind getting precarious. He's very frustrated by the fact that he's not going to get relief. So I said to him, look, Travis, I'll radio and get a second opinion, and which I did, and I described it, and the ruling was confirmed. And that still didn't satisfy him. And so he was continuing to get more and more aggravated because, I mean, he realised that he probably couldn't play the ball. And I had gone through the process of getting him to mark and lift it so we could check, you know, all of that sort of stuff. There was no question that it was embedded, that it wasn't embedded in a closely mown area, nothing of the sort. So I radio for a rover, and the rover that comes down is Graham Scott from the PGA, and Graham walks in. Graham's a great guy, very, very straight up and down, very specific and matter of fact. He looked at it. He asked the same questions. He said, yeah. And Travis pointed to the fact that some of the sand had moved when we had, even though we'd marked the ball, we lifted it to confirm it, that was his, and that it was embedded, even though it was not embedded in the right spot. And he just looked at Travis. He said, I concur with the ruling. You have to play the ball as it lies. And with that, he just walked off. And Trav still was not happy. But it was too late. And so I stepped away, not a long way away, but out of his way. And he tried to take his stance on the ball, couldn't get it, anything near it, a club near it, and called me over again to take an unplayable lie, which we took back on the line behind the bunker. He played it onto the green and ended up, I think he either got a bogey or a double bogey. I can't remember exactly, but he certainly got a bogey. And so that was a case in point where I resorted to bringing other people in because I could see. I mean, I could have just insisted after getting the second confirmation, Travis, that's it, get on and play it.
Yeah.
But that wasn't going to help him because I could see that his mental state was getting, you know, parlous. And I think, you know, that's part of our role is to try and get things done as calmly as possible. In this case, it was very difficult too because, the player didn't believe that was the case. And I'd even said to him, in the local rules, it's highlighted in yellow at the very, very top, right? I mean, it was almost the top thing in the supplementary rules for the tournament. And being a tour player, he should know the differences between the two tours. So anyway, at the end of it, after the round, I walked back to him to scoring, and I showed him the local rule and where it was highlighted, just so he was comfortable in his own mind. And whether he will go to his grave not believing it was right, really. I don't know.
Now, I don't know if you remember this, but I was with the group in front of you on that very day, and I was standing on top of the hill on the 12th tee, which is a par three, and we were waiting, our group was waiting for that green to clear. So I was, of course, looking down on you, watching all this and listening in on the radio to this and calling in Scotty and the like. And I also remember that the cameras were on this group and the cameras were on this situation being broadcast live to TV. Is that something, you know, we need to be mindful of, that, hang on, there's a bit more pressure because the cameras are on this and the player's under pressure. He doesn't want to swear or be disrespectful to the referee or the game. Is that something we need to be mindful of as well with the cameras there as well?
I think there are certain situations where you are so focused on the ruling, and this was one of them, that I didn't even realise until I turned round to walk away, and there's this camera like about 6 inches from my face that the cameras were there. Yeah. And I subsequently looked at the footage, you know, just to really assess how I behaved and how I did it and all that sort of thing, and whether there's anything I would have changed. And there are other times where you are conscious of the cameras, and sometimes you've got to ask them the cameras to move. You know, they get in the way of the player and what you're trying to do from a ruling perspective, because they don't know where you're going with the ruling. Normally, I'm pretty oblivious to them. I can't speak for the players because I don't really know, but I'm sure they do take it on board that they don't want to say anything that's going to reflect badly and get themselves fined.
Yes.
So, but you've got to be conscious of it. I do suggest, though, that, you know, you get fixed cameras that live along the ropes on fairways and things like that. I always do my best to walk behind them. I don't try. You know, you don't know if they're live, and you don't want your head bobbing through the middle of the camera. Then, you know, the television's there to watch the players, not you. So, but they do jump in. I mean, in something like the Vic Open, that the cameras are, you know, they're looking for some drama, and they'll come right in on top of you. But yeah, in this particular case, it didn't distract me, probably because I didn't realise they were there.
Since working for the PGA on that tour, I've never been more mindful of tripods and cameras, because, you know, if you get on camera too much, the guys let you know about it. If you're on TV too much, and call you Hollywood and all sorts of stuff. So we do our very best to be mindful of those cameras.
I'll tell you a funny story that in the midst of this, I just came off this ruling and my phone goes beep, beep. And I look at it, and it's a referee from New South Wales saying, good ruling.
Yeah, so, I had the same thing happen at the Athena, Peninsula Kingswood, down here in Melbourne not so long ago. And I wasn't doing a ruling. I was just walking across the fairway, again, thinking they'd gone to an ad break, and I get a text, maybe even from the same person from Golf New South Wales, says, oh, looking good, or get out of the camera or something.
Yes.
Yeah, but you're doing your best, but anyway, we're not. Anyway,
look, you can't dodge them all the time. You don't know when they're live, you know. So
and sometimes you don't even know they're there, because sometimes they're really small and handheld, and they're amongst 500 people.
Yep.
As I found. I got
a couple of short ones. To wrap it up. If that,
of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Have we got time?
Yeah.
So another one that happened. This was to do when a player marked his ball His ball had gone over the back of the green, and it was interfering with another ball that was also over the back of the green, and the players were going to putt up onto the green. So it was a steep swale down from the green, and the two balls were, you know, 30 centimetres apart. And the player called me over and he said, I've been asked to lift my ball. Just run me through the process so I know what's going on. And so the first words out of my mouth were, when you lift it, Don't clean it. and I said, now you can mark it. And I said, don't roll it in your hand and just hold it between two fingers and put it to one side if you want to on the ground, but don't roll it in your hand. And so that was fine. And he did all of that correctly and they played. And I had turned away at that stage and the hole was finished out. And as I'm walking to the next tee, another referee rocks over and he said, you know, he put that ball in his pocket. And I went, oh, you're kidding me. And the other referee said, I'll leave that with you. Big help. So he said, but he put it in his pocket. And I said, gee, I'd countenance him on that. But I didn't specifically say, don't put it in your pocket. I told you, don't roll it in your hands. But I knew that the rules specifically mentioned that. But there was one saving grace. When he picked up the ball, because I had said to him, don't clean it and hold it between your two fingers, he held it out to me and he showed me the ball. And in that, I thought, what did I see? The ball was clean. There was nothing on the ball.
Okay.
And as you very well know, the rule doesn't apply if the ball's already clean. And so he was off the hook in that regard.
Yeah.
Dodged a bullet. And I did... After the situation, I didn't talk to him then, but again, I explained to him afterwards that he shouldn't put it in his pocket. But maybe I should expand my repertoire to saying, here, don't roll it in your hand and don't put it in your pocket. So,
I've had players, not many, I've had one or two look at me in disbelief when I say, just put it on the ground. I don't roll it on the ground, but just place it on the ground, then thinking, oh, it's back in play. Now, we know it's not. There's no intent, 14.4, but... They've looked at me when I've said, put it on the ground, just put it on the ground, just put it out of the way. That's like disbelief. Anyway, that's why, and you're right, that's why they call you over. Hey, just run me through the procedure, please. Just make sure I'm okay.
I want to be sure. So, and maybe one final one, which is sort of a little bit humorous in some respects. It was an Australian Open, Royal Sydney Golf Club, fourth hole, Jeff Ogilvy. And if you don't, for those that don't know Royal Sydney in the fourth hole, it is a dogleg left, downhill to the bend, dogleg and a bend, and then uphill to the green protected by some very steep bunkers. At least that's what it was before they started rebuilding it recently. And Greg's tee shot hits a spectator, ricochets, and comes to rest embedded in the armpit, right up in the armpit of another spectator. And I scurry forward, and I hadn't seen this. I'd seen the hit, but I didn't know where it had gone after that. And so I get down there and I say to the first person, are you okay? Do you need medical attention at all? Where were you struck? You know, if it was on the head, you should see a doctor, that sort of stuff. And he said, no, he was fine. And then the other guy said, I also got hit and I've still got it. It was like Mama Bear and Papa Bear, you know, this porridge is just right sort of thing. And he was standing there with his ball wedged in his armpit. And I said, okay, just tell me, when it happened, did you move? I mean, he might have moved 3 or 4 meters or something like that. And we had to go back to where it had come to rest on him. And in fact, he hadn't moved, fortunately. So when Jeff arrived, which was shortly thereafter, he chuckled and he gave one or two of them, maybe one a glove and one a ball. And we marked the spot underneath where the guy was standing. Mm-hmm. And, of course, all the gallery's saying, what's he do here? Does he just open up his arm and drop it on the ground? You know, there was all
this. No alcohol consumed amongst all those groups.
None
at all, of course.
None at all, yes. And so at that point in time, anyway, we got him going again, got him into the right relief area, and he played on. Interestingly enough, there was an article on it in the newspaper the following day with a photograph of the guy with the ball under his armpit. I didn't even see the photographer or where the hell it came from. So it's a case in point. You know, you never know what you're going to get. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's probably, I mean, when you asked me about this, I thought, and I probably came up with 70 or 80 different scenarios and things that have come across the year. So I've just picked the eyes out of it. So, I probably everyone's asleep at this point in time.
No, definitely not. No, this is all good. People, our feedback has been, you know, when Blakey and I come on and we've just done a few events and, you know, Blakey's on the Asian tour doing something else. And people love to hear the real situations. And so it's all the things you've just shared. Now people will love to hear that. So thank you very much. It's been terrific to hear some of those real experiences and also at big events with the Australian Open and the like. Now, I know you have extensive experience in the rules. You showed us that decision book from 1996. So you've been doing this a fair amount of time. Even right now, as we speak, are there still some rules that confuse you? Are there still some that you're just not quite on top of?
Yeah, there are, and we could talk about that. And I think maybe we ought to do touch on the people that are looking at going into refereeing too at some stage. So
we can do that.
We'll come back to that if you like. Yep. Look, firstly, I want to acknowledge that the revisions of 2019 and the subsequent tidy up in 2023 was really, really positive. There are some terribly important things that happened. And I know every referee will have a different view of the world, but I think that the fact that you could mark any area a penalty area now has changed the game dramatically and given people who are setting up courses a huge number of extra options. You know, in the past, things like, you know, car parks would have to be marked out of bounds or, you know, GUR or whatever it was, or an obstruction. And it got very, very complicated. You know, penalty areas were the preserve of things that could potentially hold water. And, of course, now you can have any bit of bush or anything you like, and you can combine that with no play zones. And that is, you know, I think that and being able to ground your club, move loose impediments, do a practice swing, all of those things have contributed to improving the game and simplifying it enormously. So just a sort of a shout out to that.
Very good.
I'm not a fan of the language of 11.2 and 11.3. I think that there is probably, you know, about balls in motion being accidentally deflected or moved. Yeah. And I think that that language is a bit tortuous. It could be improved and simplified. And you can read it and reread it. I know they made a change in 2023 by to that the title, you know, when they changed it from moving to removing. But I think the language of the rules would be could benefit from a bit of a tidy up there.
Okay.
I also think that 1.3, which has the business about, it's got that line that floats around at the end of it, which sort of just hangs out there without a real owner saying, oh, and by the way, if you've made a mistake in what you're doing, you aren't exonerated from the penalty that you would have incurred anyway under, you know, under Rule 19 or Rule 17. And okay. I think that they could tidy that up as well and sort of give it a give it a place of anchor it in some other place rather than just floating it in as an extra paragraph. And I think that it also troubles me that there are times such as in if you are playing from a no-play zone, of which you see more and more of these days, that if you make multiple strokes from a no-play zone, you incur multiple GPs plus the stroke. And so you can really rack a number big time. But that's only explained in 14.7B/1, the clarification. That really needs to be moved up into 14.7. It should be in the rule, right? So that you know, and anyone who looks at that and they aren't necessarily going to the clarifications, they would go, oh, you know, I did that a number of times, no intervening event sort of thing, whether there was or not. And they just count one, you know, I played from a penalty zone when I shouldn't have been, so I'll cop the penalty, you know, and that'll be it. So, yes, I think that that's another one, another area I'd like to see tidied up. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. We will come back to just the, you know, final tips of refereeing, but
yep.
Are there any rules you'd like to introduce or change?
Definitely. Definitely. Oh, yes. Yes. I would, yeah. I have a penchant for when you play a provisional ball and your original ball is found and is unplayable and reversion to the tee under stroke and distance is your, or not necessarily the tee, but to where you last played from, under stroke and distance is your only option. I believe you should be able to revert as an additional option to your provisional ball.
Interesting.
It strikes me as anomalous that here you have, and everyone knows the provisional ball is always in the middle of the fairway, yeah. Right? And it's perfectly okay, but you've got a provisional ball there and you're already carrying the stroke and distance penalty.
Yes.
Out of that. And here you're prepared to say you've got a perfectly good provisional ball sitting there and yet you're going to force someone to go back through the field, back to wherever they were, tee up and play again and come forward again. That is completely contrary to the need for a focus on pace of play. It costs the field 10 minutes to do that. If it's a tee shot and you've got to walk back up to a tee and there are other players on the tee and you've got to interrupt them and you've got to do all this sort of stuff, it can take longer by the time that person gets back into position.
Definitely.
And it, just a simple change that allowed a provisional ball to be one of the additional options would resolve that.
As you say, they've already played that ball from the previous place. They're already copying the sort of stroke and distance because it, you know, will become the ball in play if we can't find the original or it's out of bounds. So it sort of meets all those criterion for playing under stroke and distance.
It does. I mean, it's you know, it's perfectly good. As we know, that's all. It's always perfectly good, right? So with it being a provisional ball, yeah. So there are a couple.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. You'd have to think that's come up in the committee, and they've throwing that around the table, you'd like to think at least once.
I can't think about that, but I can't think of a good reason why they'd say no.
Yeah.
There may well be, but boy, it'd have to be, you know, it's got to be on the fringe somewhere.
The fact, as you say, there's a ball there ready to go.
Yeah.
Under the same criterion that you'd be going back to the tee and playing under stroke, and there's one there ready.
Now, you know, maybe maybe they're worried about this local rule. You know, the local rule that you can introduce where you can, you got to go, you can go sideways for a lost ball or a playable ball. So you can jump at that. And maybe they thought that would fly contrary to that. I mean, you know, why would it? And another option's not a problem. Yeah. And at least in my humble opinion. Yeah.
Mm. So. Okay. Right. We'll just go back a second. We're talking about all those scenarios that you went through, and the pretext to all that I mentioned about very little guidance in the rules of golf to being an effective referee. There are many people who learn the rules and they do the club level, sort of level one and level two or other equivalents in the USGA system and the like. But we know there's a massive difference between learning all those things and then applying it for real to real people, whether it be at club level or amateur, elite amateur, professional. What are some of the tips you would give a rules enthusiast who wants to take that next step and start applying that on the course?
I think the first thing I'd say is keep calm. If you get uptight, the player will sense it immediately and will not have confidence in what you're saying. And it takes a little bit of while to learn that demeanor. And I've had it happen to me where that ball was in the middle of the bushes and they were taking back on the line relief. And she said, I said, can I pick up the ball now? And I gave it to her. And she said, can I replace this ball? And I hesitated and I went, and she said, you're not certain then. Right. So, and I said, yeah, I am. I was just ensuring that I was giving you the right answer. But that's an example point where they'll pick up on this sort of stuff straight away. So you keep calm and you've got to sound confident. And that's often harder said than done if you take all of the circumstances that we've talked about into account. Mm. Use the radio if in doubt. You've got radios available. It's not a sign of weakness. I used to think it was, but it's not. And I know you've had experience in tours and things like that. You've probably travelled on got a similar opinion now.
Yeah.
So learn from your mistakes and accept that they're going to happen. You know, we're volunteers after all, and we're doing our very best. And we want it always to be perfect, but it's not always perfect. But if it isn't and you've got something wrong, fess up to it and get it sorted out so that the player doesn't carry the disadvantage of a situation that you may or may not have put him into. So maybe you got it wrong. And as I said before, you got the right result, just you got there in the wrong way. So another thing is that if you are in these level of tournaments and you see a ball search underway, and remember, if you're roving, you may see a ball search from a distance and you could be 35 seconds from before you can get there in a cart. Start your timer then, and if you see, and you can tell when they're doing a ball search, and when you get down there, you'll probably have to adjust your timer and say to the people, how long have you been searching for? And if they come up with a time that's less than your time, you'll know that you got it at the right time. But quite often they'll say, you know, I might get there and I might only have 30 seconds on the clock, and they'd say, oh, we've been looking for at least a minute, right? You know, and you hadn't seen it, or you'd just driven into the area and you weren't able to see it. So confirm with those that are doing the searching how long they've been searching. They'll normally be pretty honest and adjust.
Especially the other players.
Yeah, exactly. So
whose ball it isn't, yeah.
That's right. I think the other thing is referee can be hours of boredom, and, you know, they say that interspersed by moments of sheer panic.
Yeah.
I've had, particularly on the women's tour, I've gone entire rounds without a ruling, you know, where the players have been so straight and so good at their job that there were no rulings and the course was clean. And you think, oh, gosh, you know, what am I doing here sort of thing? But then again, you could be thinking that, and within seconds, mayhem will burst loose. I mean, I've had that happen at the Australian Open when I was over at the most recent one over at the Lakes for the first couple of days, and not having had a ruling for, I don't know, maybe an hour or an hour and a half, 2 hours, I then had four called in within like 30 seconds, you know, and you go, well, okay, I can deal with this one and I can possibly deal with that one, but you have to lay off the other ones. I can't get there in time.
Yes.
And these things don't happen one on top of the other necessarily. They might be in adjacent holes, but they take some time to move between them.
You're on holes 5, 6, 7, I think, out the back there, weren't you, for
those
2 days?
Yeah. And it was... It ranged from being, you know, quiet to all sorts of things happening. And then I think the other thing is you'll get situations that that I call them compound rulings, where one ruling You know, you might take a ruling that's from a movable obstruction and you're dropping into an area of GUR, or that, like the one I referred to with Lydia Ko, where you're dropping into a TIO relief situations. So you need to be thinking ahead, you know, where's this going to take me? And another thing I would be saying is, if a player is taking an unplayable lie and they're taking lateral relief and it's on uneven terrain, before they pick the ball up, I would be saying to them, let's work out where you can drop this. And if it looks parlous and it could roll back into the same condition or another unplayable lie, I would tell them that. I say, you have to be aware that if this ball rolls back into that same situation, you have to take another unplayable lie for another penalty. You don't get to drop it again if it's gone back in, because it, you know, it could potentially be in, if it's in play and it's unplayable again, it's it's bad luck. Maybe that's another rule we should be changing, talking about changing. So, and the other thing you'll get to is, questions like, you know, can I clean my ball? And one I've had a number of times is when a ball is dropped into a relief area and it comes to rest right on the edge of the relief area. And we've actually had to get out a club and measure it again to ensure that at least part of it was in the relief area and it wasn't, you know, entirely outside. So you need to sort of anticipate those sorts of things happening and be aware that, you know, the ball can, and in certain circumstances, for example, if it won't come to rest, you may well end up outside the relief area if you're trying to place the ball and find a spot where it'll come to rest. So those sorts of things will happen. So, yeah, that they would be, but keep a cool head and enjoy the experience.
Very good.
Just to finish off, you asked me the other day if there are any rules that frustrate me, I think there are two quick ones. One is relief from a boundary object should be treated as an immovable obstruction. Right. I don't understand why, if you it happens to be the edge of the course, that you just don't get relief from it. But if it's an obstruction on the other side of the course or the other side of the fairway, you'll get free relief from it. Go figure. And the other one is, I would like to see the rules bodies agree that if you return to where you played the previous shot from, regardless of how you got there or the logic that led you there, that you are proceeding under stroke and distance.
Yes.
And there's no other penalty. Fortunately, we operate under the RNA and they are aligned with that thinking. And in fact, for those of us that were doing this before the rules revision, Rule 27.1A had specific language to that effect. And it said, if you go back to where you played before, basically, regardless of what happened, it's stroke and distance. Now, that language disappeared in 2019, and I don't know why it disappeared. And we have confirmed with the RNA that it indeed is still the case. So if someone goes back and they might have done it for a completely different reason, and then it is under a stroke and distance.
Yes.
The USGA, to my knowledge, doesn't necessarily accord with that same thinking. And I'd like to see that tidied up.
And a simple example of that would be on the putting green, you striking something thinking, oh, I need to replay that stroke. I'll go back and put it back and putt again. Whereas the rule says, no, you don't replay the stroke at all. You play it from where it lies. You could be deemed as playing from a wrong place because you should have been playing up near the hole. You've played it from somewhere else. But the RNA would say, no, you've made a stroke again from where you just made it. Therefore, you've proceeded under stroke and distance, even though that wasn't your thinking.
Right. And, you know, in the USGA's logic, you would get pinged two shots. And yet, if you use different languages and said, I'm going back to this spot and I am playing again under stroke and distance, then you wouldn't get pinged.
No.
So go figure. anyway, look, that sort of wraps it up from my perspective.
Okay. Very good. Well, John, I owe you a massive thanks. This has been a fantastic chat. For me personally, listening to this and what you've been able to pass on, the stories you've told, and I've learned things and I've made a few notes while you've been talking. So I really, really appreciate you sharing that with us. But of course, to our broader audience, I know there'll be lots of people around the world who'll enjoy listening to this and listening to some of the things you've passed on. So a massive thank you to you. It's been great to chat with you.
Thanks, Stuart. Thanks for your hospitality. I've enjoyed it.
Terrific. It's been my pleasure. Well, I hope you enjoyed that chat with John. He is a man with a great deal of experience. He's been very helpful to me personally in the last 2 or 3 years on my rules journey, and I certainly hope you enjoyed that. Of course, we need to finish this episode with the golf rules question of the week for episode 114, and it is as follows, very similar to the last question from the last episode. In a stroke play competition, Stuart hits his tee shot into a heavily wooded area. He properly plays a provisional ball under rule 18.3b, and it comes to rest in the right rough, short of where the original ball is estimated to be. Before commencing a search for the original ball, he makes a stroke at the provisional ball towards the green. Stuart searches for 3 minutes and cannot find his original ball. He walks towards the green and realizes that the ball he has hit was not his. It wasn't the provisional ball. Stuart returns to search for his provisional ball, but also cannot find it within 3 minutes. He returns to the teeing area and takes 6 more strokes to hole out. What is his score for that hole? That's the Golf Rules question of the week for episode 114. Please make your submissions in the usual way for your educated guess at the answer to that question. Well, again, I hope you've enjoyed this episode 114 of the Golf Rules Questions podcast. It was my pleasure to bring it to you. Hopefully, Blakey and I can get in the same room again very, very shortly and bring you the next episode. Until then, all the very best, and thanks again for listening.